Good morning. It is 9:54, Wednesday, April 29th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, still coming down off of the exhilarating high of the NFL draft.
This is Bill Finley. I'm a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News.
Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable, and I'm pleased to say that we have a three-year-old colt running on Derby Saturday. Problem is, it's for Maiden 16.
Brian DiNato, racing editor at the TDN and managing partner of Franklin Ave Equine.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Entries for the 2020 September yearling sale are open through Friday, May 1st at september.keeneland.com. Enter now and pay no entry fees for withdrawals by June 12th. Keeneland September's yearling sale will take place Monday, September 14th through Saturday, September 26th. Keeneland September is renowned for attracting the world's deepest buying bench based on the success of its graduates. Deep assortment of yearlings available. In 2019, the sale featured 1,084 individual buyers representing 25 different countries. Keeneland has adjusted its entry process for customers during this unique time. The entry deadline remains as traditional May 1st, but sellers will have the option to withdraw for an additional 6 weeks by June 12th without financial consequences. So there's really no reason not to go ahead and enter. TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. So this week, we thankfully, finally, have a big three-year-old race to look forward to, too, actually, because the Arkansas Derby was oversubscribed with 22 horses. It was split into 11 horses each, one horse scratched out of each division. So we're going to have 10 at this point in each race. Obviously, the two headliners are the two Bob Baffert horses, undefeated horses, Charlatan and Nadal, and Odor, a couple other nice horses in there. We'll go through the field a little bit later. But first takeaway for me from that, beyond just being excited to have a big three-year-old race to look forward to on what would be Derby Day, as John mentioned, is I think Charlatan got the way, way, way easier division of the race. If you look at the field, I think, you know, the only horse that I think has a chance to beat him is Gouverneur Morris. The only horse that I thought had a chance to run with him early if he goes to the lead is Shooter's Shoot. And he's one of the horses that's scratched out of the race. So drawn the rail, you would think that it's going to be a hard send. They had to redraw, actually. I don't think he had drawn the rail the first time, and then he did on the redraw. Seems like he's going to be 1-5, 2-5, and deservedly so. Nadal's got a much tougher assignment, I think. I think there's some other speed in his race. King Guillermo comes to mind. I think he's going to have a much tougher task on his hands, on his hooves, in that race. What did you guys think? What are you looking forward to the most here?
Well, first of all, I mean, is Bob Baffert leading a charmed life or not? I mean, this could not have broken any better for him in any way, shape, or form than it came out. We were looking a week ago at the possibility that there would be only one division, and if so, Charlatan wouldn't be able to run. So now, not only does he get both of his horses into the race, he doesn't have to run them against one another, something I'm sure that he really didn't want to do. So, Joe, on Charlatan, we'll find out a little bit about him, but maybe not a whole lot. You're absolutely right. This division came up really much weaker of the two. He drew perfectly. He's got the inside post, should go right to the lead. But one thing I want to bring up, and then I'll shut up because maybe this is something other people want to talk about as well. But what happened there that Drayden Van Dyke is off that horse for Martin Garcia? And if you recall, he had Drayden Van Dyke on Justify early in his career and took him off from Mike Smith. So, you know, what is the relationship with Van Dyke and Bob Baffert? I think that's something to look at. Second division, yes, terrific race, much better. I think we will find out something about Nadal because it is going to be a dogfight, it looks like, for him in a race where it's a lot tougher. And I also have seen some people criticizing Oakland for splitting the race. I couldn't disagree more. You know, right now, they're trying to do what's best for horse racing, do what's best for the horsemen. And you got to give them a lot of credit for that. And these people desperately need a place to run their three-year-olds, which is the reason why 22 horses were entered in this. And this is costing Oakland extra money, an extra $250,000 to put on this race. And they're not going to profit from it in any way, yet they're giving the horsemen a chance to run their horses and get them points for the Derby, get them into good races for the Derby, just give them a place to run right now. So I know I said a lot, but those are my feelings off the top of my head.
No, I think you guys have a pretty good analysis of what's going on with the races. Number one, that the first division is the softer of the two divisions. The second race, part of the Arkansas Derby has five grade one or grade two winners in it. And the first division does not even come close to that. That being said, you know, one of the things that I've talked about over the years is the fact that I'm an East Coast guy. I have an East Coast bias. You know, I prefer the New York Giants over the San Francisco Giants, the Bagels over Avocado Toast, and Beastie Boys over. I'm an East Coast guy. I didn't even like going to the Breeders' Cup in Santa Anita, you know, at first until I got there. That being said, there are like 10 or 11 West Coast California horses that are, you know, all kind of coming to a head in this, in these two races, as well as some of the other, you know, hopefully future Derby preps. I mean, you know, I know the number one horse on the list right now is Tis the Law, but Charlton, Shooter Shoot, Wrecking Crew, Thousand Words, Honor AP, Storm the Court, A New Dior, Nadal, Fast Enough, Ginobili, and Authentic all started and all have had their careers in California. So as much as I love the East Coast, God, you got to look at these West Coast horses, and they look like they're going to dominate, you know, some of these races coming into the Kentucky Derby. I'm going to leave it to you guys as far as what horses to pick in the various races. But to me, it was like, you know, hitting me over the head about just how incredible these West Coast horses are coming in.
Beastie Boys versus Tupac. That's an interesting juxtaposition, John.
Well, you know, I'm a little older than you, Bri. So, you know, you got to go with what got me going in college. Beastie right. Boys.
Tupac is looking for his unemployment check in Kentucky.
Yeah, I saw that in Kentucky.
Sure,
yeah,
I heard that too.
I agree with everyone said about the first division. It looks like it's hard to see Charlton losing. The only horse I thought maybe could be interesting is Anodor, just because he has to be better than his last performance. And he seems like a true mile and an eighth or longer horse. But it's hard to look past Charlton in that race. And he definitely, the redraw certainly helped him. I'm pretty sure Wells Bayou was in his race the first time through. And I think there was an issue with overlapping ownership. I'm guessing it was Charlotte and Wells Bayou. I think Saul has a piece of both. I could be wrong about that. But the rule at Oaklawn is if there's any kind of same ownership, they can't run in the same race when they split races like that. Second division, I'm kind of with you guys where I'm against Nadal. I thought King Guillermo was super interesting. I'll probably end up singling him. I just think his last race was actually legitimate. And the rest of his, it's not like it came out of nowhere. I think if you look back at his previous form, now having seen what he did at Tampa Bay, it looks a lot better and can't really fault him. I guess the post isn't great. He's inside the other speed, but if he can kind of get outside and get a nice stalking trip, I think he could run a huge race.
Brian, you would like King Guillermo better than like Silver Prospector who had an excuse for the last race or Farmington Road who ran a really big second last time? You'd single him? That's a bold statement, the single horse.
That's how you make money, John.
Like 8-1. That's his thing.
That's how you make money. I'm not going to spread 7 deep. Come on. I mean, I think he's just got the most upside. I mean, figure-wise, he ran faster than Nadal on some figures, at least last time. Right. And I think he might have another step up. Silver Prospector is what he is. A lot of those, you know, Farmington Road needs to get a lot faster. I just think he has, you know, I think King Guillermo is the type of horse who could step up and run a 105 buyer or something and, you know, run a really big race.
Wow.
Maybe not 105. He doesn't have to run 105, but it wouldn't shock me.
I think the main thing is not getting hooked up and cooked by Nadal early on.
Yeah.
The pace is right. Going to be really interesting to watch in that race, because I think you have a handful of horses that could be either on the lead or close to the lead. Whereas I think in the other race, it's kind of Charlatan's race to win or lose on the front end. To Bill's point about Bob Baffert and Martin Garcia, it's like they've broken up more times than Sid and Nancy and gotten back together. Like he can't quit him. I think, I feel like Baffert has fired Martin Garcia 10 different times and he always comes back to him. So I feel like it's more of that. They just can't quit each other than something against Drayden Van Dyke. Just want to run down some of the other horses that are in these races. You guys talked about Silver Prospector, Wells Bayou, Farmington Road, King Guillermo, Storm the Court. Those are all in the Nadal division of the race. Like I said, it's pretty much just Gouverneur Morris and maybe Anodor who are in the in Basin, who, you know, had that great 2-year-old season, but really hasn't run back to it yet. Those are the main ones in the Charlatan division. Also wanted to mention the Fantasy. The Fantasy's got 14 horses and is going to be run Friday. Grade three with 14 horses and $400,000 purse. The greatest filly of all time, Harvey's Little Goyle. We finally get to see her again. She's in there, yeah. along with Venetian Harper, Swiss Skydiver, who just won the Gulfstream Oaks, Lake Avenue, She Dares the Devil, who looked pretty good switching to the Brad Cox barn, British Idioms in there as well. So that's also a terrific race. 14 horses as well in the Oakland Handicap, $600,000 grade two. Not as many household names in there, but still some solid horses like Mr. Freeze, Combatant, who just won a grade one at Santa Anita, Tacitus, Trophy Chaser, who looks to be an up-and-comer, Improbable by My Standards, who's kind of a fairgrounds terror. So overall, just a terrific weekend of racing. I'm not going to bet it because I told you guys I don't bet Oakland, but I wish you all good luck, and I'm happy that they're still putting on this show because God knows we needed it as racing fans.
A minor shout out just on the Arkansas Derby. I don't know if you noticed who the breeder was of Crypto Cash. I'll give you a guess.
Who the hell is Crypto Cash?
Thank you. Crypto Cash is actually in the field. That's all that matters. He's got a shot. There's still a chance.
I'm trying to find him now.
Joe, I'll give you a guess.
DJ Stables. Okay, I've heard
there
of him.
There you go. There you go. That's what we like to hear.
Yeah. But any actual thoughts on the rest of the races, John?
There are two daredevils in the Philly race, and John and I have a little rooting interest in a daredevil right now. So I'd like to see one of those do well. So some more self-promotion. Exactly.
You'll hear more about that filly, and you'll probably read about her in next year's Bill Finley Oaks Dozen.
So wait, you guys own a daredevil together? Is that what you're hinting at?
We do. Go ahead, Brian. You can take over on that one.
No, just a little filly out of OBS March. John had purchased and contacted me about, and I had some good notes on her. So a little New York bred that I'm pretty excited about.
Gotcha. Cool.
And her name is Full of Fire. Full of Fire.
Not Topsy Turvy.
Topsy Turvy's already been reserved.
I've never felt so betrayed in life.
Topsy Turvy's already been reserved for a Derby candidate. She's a filly, so we couldn't necessarily use the name on her. That was why.
All right.
It's kind of general. Don't worry. We'll make that announcement on show number 100. That'll be when we get to show 100, we'll unveil who Topsy Turvy is.
A long way away, John.
That's all right. I have faith.
We got a pandemic to get through first. I can't wait that long. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they were bred to save you money. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com. This week's Green Group Guest of the Week, returning champion, executive director of the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation, Pat Cummins. Thanks so much for joining us, Pat.
Thanks, Joe. Good morning.
Glad to have you. So we'll start with this. You have these free data Fridays at the TIF, these short white papers that kind of address these broad issues in racing and crystallize it into a specific example. Last week was about the California model. And what I was surprised about is how little purse money, not just in California, but across the country, how little handle goes to purse money. My question to you is, how did that happen and how can it be remedied?
Well, I think the short answer is it's been happening like this for a very long time. And the situation has really just worsened bit by bit, year after year. And I think as an industry, the topic has generally just kind of been kicked down the lane. And it didn't help that most jurisdictions have been supported with some sort of revenue from casinos. Now, There's a very good argument that horse people can make that they can say that casinos at racetracks are only there because of the racetracks. And that's a very fair point. I get it. And you know, yes, that's absolutely true. But in many cases, about 15 or 20 years has gone by and people's memories start to fade a little bit and they lose sight of the fact that racing is what brought the casinos in the first place. So I think we're losing touch with that argument. And you look at a place like California, and it's a place, a jurisdiction that has not had any influence of casinos. And even still, they've made things work over the years. And only about 4.4% of total handle actually goes to prize money. And at the end of the day, all different factions can argue from whichever perspective they want to, but if we don't have the horses to race, we don't have a sport. So at its most fundamental level, we need horses to race. What do the people that buy those horses need? They need to supplement their ongoing costs. They don't need to profit, right? We don't, this isn't a necessity in the sport. If it was, we still wouldn't be around. They're you know, what the old joke about what's the best way to end up with a small fortune in horse racing, start with a large one. It's true, right? But we need owners to be able to cover their costs. And that has been an increasing challenge in certain places, California certainly among them. And it's going to be an increasing challenge in jurisdictions that start losing casino revenues, which we just see going to happen slowly over time.
Hey, Pat, good morning. It's Bill, and thanks for joining us. And one of the things you've been talking about and you put in your white paper is the broken model. And you could call many things the broken model, but particularly the fact that the ADWs are making huge profits and they're taking the bulk of all the money that comes in the revenue from making bets. Tracks like Fonner Park only get 3% of what is bet on a race there. I don't know what all the other dollars and cents and percentages are, but it goes up to 5, 6, 7%. But it doesn't seem fair or right that the ADWs keep all this money. Matter of fact, it should be, the percentage should be the opposite. The tracks should be getting the bulk of the money and the ADW should be the ones getting the 3 or 4%. We know if we could fix this, it would make horse racing a lot better, more viable sport. Tracks would be more profitable, purses would be bigger. My question is, how do we get the toothpaste back in the tube though?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's one that's been debated for a long time. We have another piece coming out this Friday that takes it to the next level, Bill, where you know, we cite some of the real specifics and look back on the old Jockey Club Roundtable from 13 years ago in 2007, where they brought together then the president of TVG, then the head of Churchill Downs Incorporated, which was Robert Evans, and then the chairman of the National HBPA, which was a fellow out of Pennsylvania named Joe Santana, who was an accountant. And the three of them get up and basically say, yeah, the model's broken. It's not perfect. We need to fix it. Well, at that time, and it's even referenced in the transcript of that dialogue, 10% of all wagering was going through the ADWs. That number is now well over 40%. And it's only going to get bigger. And if anything, what we've seen is that the pandemic has crunched the timeline on that. It's led to a significant opening in accounts. And it might be difficult to get players back. And we shouldn't have to compete for the value of a player's dollar by saying sending players to the track is more meaningful to keep racing going than it is keeping them at home. The value of the money that is coming into purses from handle should be coming no matter where you are. Getting the toothpaste back in the tube, though, it's going to require everyone to sit down and start over and rebuild the model. And it can be done. Horse racing just doesn't have a really good way of doing that. It's physically going to have to happen. I don't think talking about it is necessarily going to turn the trick. But what we have done with this paper and what has been talked about for years is trying to raise awareness to the fact that conversation needs to happen. It hasn't happened. And of all the different pieces that we've put out on our site over this quote-unquote free day to Friday series, which has now run 31 weeks or so, this was the one where we got the most private feedback from owners, trainers, people we had never heard from before who said, wow, this is a real problem. We need to get our hands on this. And we're saying, please do. That's the point. Raising the awareness, not enough people have realized that this is a really kind of significant problem. There's a cliff ahead of us. And if we fall off that cliff, it's going to be tough to get ourselves back up.
Pat, thanks again for being on board with you know, such an important topic. You know, when you were on back in February, it seems like it was a whole different world. It was pre-pandemic, and you know, things were kind of moving forward, and the calendars were all set, and we'd be talking about Derby entries instead of you know, some of the other factors. But sometimes, you know, that's important to have a pause in certain situations so you can reassess and then move forward with the strategy. One of the questions that was asked to you last time was ultimately, how are we going to get this disjointed industry together again? And maybe the pandemic, it took a pandemic to kind of get us to this point where we're reassessing all the information, great information that you have on your site, as well as forcing kind of all the factions of the industry to get together. So my basic question is, you know, it doesn't matter how we got here. It's what's the next step? How do we get everyone into the room together virtually or actual physically to start having these meaningful conversations again? Because there's a lot of factions that need to be represented, but ultimately we all have a love for the industry and love for the animal and the athlete. So give us a game plan of how we can do that.
Well, the madness of when I last spoke to you on the podcast was after our previous piece was released, which we had called American Racing Sustainable Future. And it highlighted the fact that decoupling is coming. It's coming hard. States are going to lose these, for lack of a better word, subsidies, these purse enhancements that come from sources that are beyond wagering. And that something is going to need to happen to pull the industry together. And you know, we certainly got some feedback on the paper and whatnot, as we do with most of them. But about 4 or 5 days later, and this is something that you guys have discussed, the governor of Pennsylvania comes in and says, we're taking that money for college scholarships. And I've always been fearful of when someone wants to put a plan together, if they put a name to the plan and a story behind the plan, it tends to make it help stick a little bit more. And when I saw the budget address from the governor of Pennsylvania, I said, oh, this is over. The Nellie Bly Scholarship Fund, let's make a student stand up and talk to him about how he's going to qualify for this money. It was really dangerous for racing at that point. And they, to use Bill's phrase, are trying to put that money back in the tube. And they're struggling to do it. But I think the governor's plan is going to struggle too, considering the economic situation and where things are at the moment. So, look, at some point we get to a tipping point, right? We get to a point where racing can no longer ignore this broken financial model. And we wonder what it's going to be. I tweeted something earlier this week. It was a link to the YouTube video of the 1990 Kentucky Derby broadcast on ABC. And Dave Johnson and Al Michaels are on the roof of Churchill Downs. And they're talking about this new study that was released by the Jockey Club that said Lasix may be a performance-enhancing drug. Now, that's 30 years ago. We have only seen the debate rage for 3 decades, clearly, on this topic. Right? This has been the one thing that has galvanized people. And now you have these voices that come out and say the only thing that's going to save racing is if we can get a handle on this, if we can get a federal bill, if we can advance the sport in some capacity and solve this Lasix issue. Okay, if that's the case, fine. Let's just get it and move on. It's time to focus on other things that are wrong with our sport, because we have a lot of problems and we haven't solved a lot of them over those 30 years. So as much as Lasix and permissive race day medication are important, we're talking about how we fund the business. We're not talking about what permissive medication is used or isn't used, and the threats and the considerations that come with how horses may or may not be able to come back and race, and the threat of a horse that bleeds and whatnot. We're talking about how do we make the day-to-day operations of racing continue. I think that the fundamental business model of the sport maybe takes a little more precedence over do we allow permissive anti-bleeder medication or not. But yet that topic has gotten all of the coverage, all of the debate, and really has separated parties on two extremes. I think everybody should be in agreement that the financial model of racing needs to be fixed. When you start putting the numbers out and you look at, you know, if the California model was spread out across America, that purses would drop by about 60%. That should wake people up to say, all right, let's put this Lasix topic on the side, or let's just sort it and get it solved and move on. I'm not for a federal bill. I'm not against a federal bill. I'm for racing. And I think that there is a more fundamental business concern that we need to get sorted. And however it is that, that we go about that, we need to get that, we need to get that ball rolling, and it hasn't been for quite some time.
Pat, you talk about the California model, and obviously they've had other issues in the last year or so. Could you make the case that maybe they're a little better suited for once decoupling comes and all that? Maybe they're just, they haven't been kind of artificially propped up. Are they maybe in a better position long-term, if anybody is?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, without a doubt, Brian, I mean, they've survived, right? And there are some things that we made very clear in the paper last week, the Free Data Friday last week, where we said, there are some assumptions that are being made here to come up with these numbers, right? And, you know, California at the end of the day is still able to command a legitimate rate on its races because it's quality, and it always has been. People want to bet Santa Anita, Del Mar, Golden Gate, obviously to a lesser extent, the fares to a lesser extent, but it's not Sunland, it's not Penn National, it's not Indiana Grand, it's not Mahoning Valley in the dead of winter. It's Southern California, it's California in general. So they are definitely better positioned, but they're better positioned for a really bad future, right? If that were to come to be the case, they've shown a way to succeed despite a lack of these revenues that other states have. Look, California is interesting, right? It's on an island, essentially. It's an island unto itself. Craig Burdick, you know, who founded the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation, has long advocated for creating a circuit between Northern California and Southern California, and you know, do something like 3 months on, 3 months off sort of thing between the two, and create one viable circuit and maybe raise the power of California racing. There's a lot of things that could be done there, but California is still going to be California, and they have proven that they can survive in this environment. To take your point, though, Brian, to allude to the other problems that California has had, one thing that the research on this project uncovered that I found pretty surprising is the lack of money that has actually gone to the state of California. So a lot of these, they're carve-outs, right? Different pieces that have gone to different areas. Well, in 2009, that was the last year that the state of California received a license fee from Handle. They received, I think it was about $31 million. And in 2010, that money was gone and it never came back. And based on some research and some phone calls, there was a bit of a change. And basically the CHRB had to fund itself from Handle. And so the state of California, the general fund in Sacramento, is actually getting no money direct from wagering on racing. There's plenty of indirect money, okay? No argument about that. Licensing, taxes, in other elements of the sport, but they're not getting it from wagering. The local governments themselves have actually gotten a lot less money too. 10, 20 years ago, if you adjusted for inflation, actually, back to 1999, the local governments, the actual cities and towns where racetracks are in California, they got about $11 million a year that they split. That number last year was about $2.5 million. So horse racing has seemingly become less valuable to the state of California's general fund, to the municipalities where racing is. And I think it makes the case that racing is important a little bit tougher. And that is something that I think really needs to be tackled in some capacity to make sure that people realize that, that racing has a say. And we've seen what has happened this week with the protests, the positive protests, if you will, to say, let's get back to racing. We can do that. And the fights that have been had with the health department, that have been had with the animal welfare interests. At the end of the day, horse racing has given a lot less to California in recent years than it had been before. And, you know, maybe money's talking a little bit in the way in which racing's being treated.
You made an interesting argument in the paper about the alignment of the wants of bettors and the needs of horsemen. And I think that's, it's really interesting to think about that way. And I'll read a quote here. It says, horsemen need revenue from takeout now and likely more in the future than ever before. That should not mean raising the price of betting. That's exactly the wrong move. that seems kind of counterintuitive. It seems that you raise takeout that's bad for the bettors, but the purses go up. You lower takeout that's good for the bettors, but the purses go down. Can you explain how those interests can be better aligned?
Yeah, great point, Joe, and thanks for raising it. I think a lot of times the argument of we need more money for purses gets heard by horse players as you're going to raise takeout on us. And that to us is a counterintuitive. I think here's the best way to maybe put this into consideration, and it's something we're going to publish later this week. Let's ignore 2019 in California for 1 second, right? They had a bunch of cancellations. I don't think it's a fair shake, and it's frankly not a fair shake for 2020 either, but let's just go back to 2018. If you compared the amount of wagering that happened on track and at satellite betting facilities in California with 2010, both of those figures are down 30%. So we've seen on-track handle and off-track through satellite wagering, OTB handle in California, down 30% within an 8-year period of time. At the same time, ADW handle was up 8%. Well, the two don't wash. It wasn't that all of the money moved from on-track and satellite to ADWs. They were off about, I think it was about $260 million was the wash. If California wanted to get their purse contributions back to the same level that they were at in 2010, and on-track and satellite betting stayed exactly the same, they would need to see ADW revenue increase 35%. Well, you guys all know that there is no metric in horse racing that talks about foal crops, handle, purses, number of races, whatever, averages, that has ever been up 35%, right? But that is what would need to happen in order to get there. Well, how are you going to see an actual increase in wagering in horse racing? Increasing the takeout is not going to do that. So we need to create more betting, and we need to create a way to get more revenue to purses. Just increasing the price of betting is going to decrease the amount of money that people have to bet later on. So it's really simple economics to us that that is not the way to do it. Conversely, if you can derive ways to cut overall takeout, then yes, we think that will increase the amount of money in the hands of bettors, money that they've already put aside for betting, and that will increase overall churn from which the state of California, or not really the state based on what I said relative to the tax situation, but the California horsemen or horsemen anywhere are going to get more of. So I think you can make more by giving back more, which will help the overall churn. It's a simple argument, but raising pricing, I don't think, is the answer. And it hasn't been the answer. We have actually seen overall takeout rise slowly from, say, the 1940s and 50s up to where we are. You can go back through old publications, old racing forms, and see stories about where takeout was. Blended takeout, 12, 13%. As that number has risen, so too has the competition in wagering. It defies logic. The lotteries come into play. Now we have casinos in play. Now we have sports betting in play. If you consider raising the price of your gambling, the expense of gambling to the customer in light of a more competitive environment than ever, and really a troubling revenue situation, you know, there's no hope if we're going to raise takeout. I think the only way is lowering takeout. So then what do we have to do? We have to figure out who's going to get less. And that's a conversation that people seemingly don't want to have, but has to be had. Are these quote-unquote middle people, the technological operators in the middle, the hub fees that get paid to ADWs, they're getting sometimes 5.5% on bets that go directly to them. And that's of the total dollar. That's a big, big cut that they end up taking. And I think is it taking money away from them? Sure it is. But I think it's more about getting a fair and equitable split as opposed to taking something away from one entity or one group.
Pat, so much of what we've been talking about today is on the subject of how do we increase the amount of money that's wagered on the sport. And a lot of people look at the pandemic and what has happened to American society and sports in general. And what I'm talking about there is that racing is pretty much the only gambling game in town. It's pretty much the only live sporting event in town, that this is a tremendous opportunity for the sport to get new people involved, to get new bettors, and hopefully keep them when things get back to normal. Has racing done enough to get these new customers and take advantage of this situation? If not, what should they be doing that they're not doing?
Yeah, I think the answer is no, Bill. They haven't done enough. There was an interesting piece out the other day from Dean Towers, who I know has written for TDN in the past too, and put in some op-eds. And he made it very clear that these are not earned customers. These are new customers by default that we have seen come to horse racing in the confines of this pandemic. Now would be a great time to invest and actually attempt to get these customers and get them to stay. I know Jason Wilson from Equibase, who has responded to our piece in a letter to TDN last week, and he came out and said, look, you know, we're giving away free tips, access to Stats Race Lens for some true odds and things like that. I'm glad Jason responded. I'm glad that he has been responsive to our free data call. But the one thing that I was a little concerned by was his comment that traditional past performances are difficult to understand. And, you know, people, almost everyone that I've encountered in racing who has gotten into it was attracted by learning and attracted by trying to understand the puzzle of the sport. Joe Applebaum said it pretty well on last week's discussion with you guys. Horse racing needs investment and finding investment. I couldn't agree more with him. This is a troubled asset. And while there is certainly plenty of risk that comes with investing in troubled assets, right now you could buy low in horse racing. You know, you can get in and get a piece of the action to make an investment and try and turn this around. If we look at our sport as having been neglected at the business level for decades, coming in now, we do have some technological infrastructure. We do have something we can build. Now would be the time to invest in getting our customers, retaining our customers, giving them data, letting them have at it. You know, I see stories about e-gaming, e-sports, the fantasy gaming components that are being tied to e-sports and the data that's available for bettors to be analyzing in that respect. That is significant. And yet we don't have a way in which we could attract all these people who are captive at home and have access to reams and years and decades of horse racing data. We could be giving that to them right now. We could be trying to build an audience, but yet it seems like we just kind of focus on the next day and the next quarter and kind of just getting by, as opposed to thinking in a broader long-term perspective as to how we can retain those customers that we may be attracting at this point. It's a real concern. I wish it's something that we would do more of. And it's hopefully something we're trying to inspire.
Pat, you talked earlier about how you got a pretty good response to last week's paper. What are some other topics where you've been pleased, maybe making some headway, and then maybe a topic that's just kind of surprised you of how it's fallen on deaf ears?
The topic, I think, without question, that has gotten us the best response has been Category 1, the Category 1 stewarding rules. We've had tremendous pickup from the province of Ontario, working in partnership with Woodbine on that. And they have, you know, they put out a survey, did the regulator up there, the Alcohol Gaming Commission of Ontario, AGCO. They continue to talk about it and try to evolve. And what goes hand in hand with that was our paper about seeking transparency, about trying to lift the integrity and reporting arm of the sport. We just put out a piece today that was a recreation, or if you will, an original creation of what an actual Kentucky Derby stewards report from last year would have looked like. And it's inspired by the stewards reports that are published day in and day out by stewards around the world on racing, where they really dig into what has happened during a race, what is the explanation as to why some decision was made, what they saw, how they adjudicated the race, as opposed to just a 40-word or a 40-second statement that was read 2 hours after the mess of the race. And what we're trying to show people is that, hey, here is something that can be done. Here is a way in which we can take our sport more seriously. And I'd say that is, you know, to think that there is a jurisdiction on this continent that is very seriously considering a shift in the rule structure to get on board with the international rules, when essentially no one in this country was talking about it prior to when we really brought it up and have kind of campaigned for it. I think that's the area where we've had the most success at this point. And look, I mean, who doesn't want more integrity in horse racing? I can only think it's people who have something to hide or who want to continue operating in the dark. Our sport is taken very seriously in places that you might not necessarily consider betting day in and day out. You know, the stewards reports that come out of Malaysia, that come out of Zimbabwe. I could say that they're far better than what comes out of America, but nothing comes out of America. So, you know, there's a tremendous opportunity, like I said, to get in low and to really start building a better infrastructure. As Joe stated last week, we need investment. These things do cost money, but there's money out there. There is a sport that has a tremendous amount of annual investment, and there's every reason for us to invest in it. We could do those things. I would say, to the point about being disappointed, definitely I'm disappointed on the lack of free data. What has been done so far is nowhere close to enough, Brian. It needs to be more. We need to at least test this, test the water. What is the harm in testing the waters to see how people react to it? You know, it's not as if we're on this steady 6% annual growth rate, year over year, compounded growth. It's been great. It's just the opposite. So what's the harm in trying these new things and testing the waters? Is it because we're racing and we don't like change? Well, that hasn't really done us well. It hasn't served us well, and the metrics are very negative. So for us, there's every reason, there's every incentive to change, and I think we should. We'd also love to see more movement on breakage. We had a go with New York and talked about it a little bit, but that has not evolved. It's been very frustrating. We would love, you know, it's $50 million a year that sits out there, the majority of which is retained by the middlemen. If you make a bet on an ADW and there's breakage on the return, that breakage is retained by the ADW. No portion of that goes to horsemen. Now, breakage on track, some of that does go to horsemen. Some of it goes to purses. But you know, ADW breakage, which is probably maybe $20 million a year that's just sitting out there, why can't that go back to bettors? There's every reason that it should, and give it to them and let them churn it.
Before we let you go, we know you got a call coming up. I have one more question about Remington, because this was something that got you guys some attention. For those people who don't know, the basic is that a guy was alive for the entire Sooner Six jackpot, and then two horses, he had both of them dead heated for the win, and the track tried to say that made it so that there were two separate tickets and not one ticket, obviously a ridiculous ruling. I just say, personally, as a bettor, I would love to have you guys in my corner, because it seems like you're making some real headway here. What got you to get involved in that front on his behalf?
Yeah, we had the bet had been placed on a Friday night. The following Tuesday evening, I had received a call telling me about this situation and that someone was trying to connect us with the bettor involved. We got connected with him the next day on Wednesday, and they started racing again on Thursday. So we put out our story on Thursday and basically said, please, and talked to Remington and said, please don't issue this jackpot. Don't put it back out there. We're pretty sure this guy has the only ticket, and we'd love to see you do the right thing here and pay the man. I think the case is very crystal clear. What isn't clear are the rules in Oklahoma, which are nowhere near as defined on how you deal with single ticket jackpots like you would in some other jurisdictions. The Santa Anita rule on the jackpot is very clear. The West Virginia rule is very clear. And in those situations, this customer clearly wins. In Oklahoma, that rule is not spelled out at all. That, you know, basically what Remington told this gentleman is, because of the dead heat, you've disqualified yourself from winning the single ticket, even though his bet and the combinations were on the single ticket. If he had only had one of the two horses, I mean, think about how ridiculous this argument is. If you had only used one of these two horses that were in the dead heat, if you spent less money wagering on this race, you would have won. That's a tough argument to have and to suggest to a customer that's the right approach in any way, shape, or form. So really where it stands right now, Joe, is it's with the Oklahoma Racing Commission. They suspended the bet. They only let it go on one extra day. No one hit it, thankfully. I joked on Twitter that, you know, Jeff Arthur's money is out there to be won tonight. If anybody wants to go after it. But they did. I mean, they built the jackpot up for an extra $11,000, I think. So he's the rightful winner of $35,000. He was only paid about $9,000. That money is still sitting there. I'm hopeful that the Oklahoma Racing Commission is going to do the right thing. Regardless, I think this is going to yield a rule change for the future. But I think everyone is just waiting to hear from the commission what they end up doing, and hopefully there will be a positive response. But look, this wasn't earth-shattering money for the better. It's not earth-shattering money for the track. But there is the right thing you need to do by your customers. And we just can't let those sorts of examples go by where our customers are not being treated in the best possible way.
All right, Pat, thank you so much for the time, man. We appreciate it. And stay safe and keep up the good fight.
Thanks, guys. All the best. Appreciate it.
Thanks, see Pat.
Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As The Green Group Guest of the Week, Pat Cummings will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. The Green Group, bred to save you money. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, bred to save you money.
This week's news is sponsored by West Point Thoroughbreds. Owning a multiple graded stakes winning racehorse like Hard Not to Love is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and chances for a big horse. Check out why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit their website, westpointtb.com. So it's been quiet on the West Point front in terms of racing, as it has been for pretty much everybody in terms of racing recently. But May 2nd, first Saturday in May, and while it won't be the run for the roses, West Point hopes to take a big step toward the rescheduled Kentucky Derby with Winning Impression in the Arkansas Derby. Their colt finished first April 4th in a race over the track at Oaklawn, but was disqualified for interference. And this is another chance for Dallas Stewart to work his long shot magic in a big race. We wish all of our friends at West Point the best of luck this weekend and going forward with Winning Impression, and enjoy the Arkansas Derby, guys. So this week's big news is on the sale front. You know, I mean, we have the Arkansas Derby to look forward to, but I think the big news that has more longstanding and wide-ranging implications is the news that Facing Tipton is going to be condensing its three summer yearling sales, the July sale, the Saratoga Select sale, and the New York Bred Yearling Sale at Saratoga, into one yearling sale, which is going to take place September 9th and 10th, which will be a week before the Keeneland September sale. I think the big takeaway here is, while it might be inconvenient for some people, I think the coordination between the two sales companies is a big thing here. And I think this is something where people in the industry have stepped up and realized that we kind of all have to get through this and coordinate this together. And it doesn't behoove anybody to be competing at a time like this when there's so little going on. And maybe they should give a call to the tracks that are still running on top of each other, even though there's only two or three tracks running. on the weekends. But I want to give a big shout out to Facebook and Keeneland. Obviously, there are some negative implications. I think for me, the one that stands out is if you had a New York Red Yearling sale, a New York Red Yearling to sell at Saratoga, you used to have that one night to really be spotlighted, and you have a lot of the same buyers from the Saratoga sale. Now you're kind of mixed in with everything else. You might get overshadowed a little bit. So I think that if you're a New York Red Yearling seller, is a little disappointing. But I think overall, pushing it back and consolidating is the right way to go as we transition into a post-pandemic sales and racing world. I'm going to leave it to our two owners here, John and Brian. John, I'll start with you. What do you think?
I think overall, it's a wonderful thing that there's some coordination in the industry, like you mentioned, Joe. The fact that Boyd Browning at Fasig and the very talented group at Keeneland got together and said, hey, we need to figure this out together. I know that we're rivals normally, but we really need to put our heads together and coordinate a schedule to make it best for the net sum of the buyers and sellers and consigners. I think the kudos go to both organizations for doing that. Again, like everything else in the industry the past couple of years, it's going to polarize things a little bit. The top end horses are still going to sell really well. As a matter of fact, they may sell better. In case in point is when Fasig broke off the Night of the Stars night a couple of days before the Keeneland sale, and that sale has exploded. And horses that normally would sell for, again, this is anecdotal, horses that we thought would sell for a certain amount of money sold for 30, 40, 100% more than we thought they should have. So to have a designated, select day and carve it out and post it right before the Keeneland's select days, I think is going to be a great thing. Again, Joe, I hate to always agree with you, but I think on this one, you're spot on. If you have a modestly bred New York bred or just an average looking New York bred that normally would stand out in the select New York night at Saratoga, and now you're bringing it to Kentucky and you're going to have to go against not only the Saratoga horses, which is tough enough, the Saratoga New York breds, which is tough. Now the July horses, and on top of that, you're right before the select days of book one and book two at Keeneland, you're going to get lost in the shuffle. There's no doubt about it. But it's a new world. And basically, you have to accept what opportunities avail themselves. So if you have a really well-bred, really good-looking horse, it's going to sell very well, whether it's at the Fasig sale or if it's book one at Keeneland. You can make an argument for both. But some of those other horses are going to kind of all back in sales opportunities because they don't have their select or their individual night. And I think that's just the reality of the world that we're in, at least for 2020. Hopefully going forward, we'll be back to normal and there'll be a July Fasig sale and there'll be the Saratoga sales and subsequently the September sales at Keeneland. But I think for right now, you have to kind of accept, the lay of the land the way it is. And move forward and hope that you have a good enough horse and that there's end users that want to buy those horses.
I would say I doubt most of the lower level New York breds will end up at that sale. There's a mixed sale up in Saratoga in I think October that I think they sell yearlings at, and I think they'll probably have more yearlings there this year. And there's also the Mid-Atlantic sale also in October in Timonium. And you see a lot of New York breds there. So I'm guessing a lot of the, maybe the New York sired kind of horses will show up there. It is interesting though that Larry Best bought the topper last year at the New York bred sale. He just had happened to be in town. He was at Saratoga anyways. The story goes that he kind of like just showed up there and found the best horse and bought her for, I think it was a record price. So I wouldn't think he won't be at these other smaller sales, but the real big, like fancy New York breds can kind of sell in any market. So I don't think it'll hurt them too much. It might hurt the lower level ones a little bit, but I don't think it's going to be a total disaster. One thing I thought was a little interesting, I think Fasig's still planning to do its Horses of Racing Age sale in July. And it's one day before OBS's final two-year-old sale. So you're probably not going to have a lot of agents in Kentucky. They're probably going to be down in Florida, I would think. The nice thing is with Horses of Racing Age, really it's just a matter of looking at the PPs and having vetted, and the vet, the vet will give them a good look over, but it'll be interesting to see how that dynamic works out.
I think a lot of this is based on allowing the two-year-old sales calendar to complete before we get into yearlings. And, I don't know for sure that these two big two-year-old sales that are on the calendar right now OBS April sales were pushed back to June 9th through 12th. And then Basic Mid-Atlantic has been pushed back to June 29th through 30th. I hope that those can go off at those dates, but who can say anything for certain right now? So I think a lot of this is based on giving the two-year-old market room to breathe, giving the sellers a chance to get money back in their pocket to reinvest in yearlings. Do you guys, I don't know, it's obviously all speculation, but what do you think about the two-year-olds? Do you think that we'll be able to have enough of a break between the two-year-old sales season and the yearling sales season?
You know, that's a great question, Joe. And I don't know if they're going to, if in a perfect world, they're going to be able to have that extra time between the two-year-old sales and the yearling sales. And if you look at historically at the top buyers for yearlings, it's the big end users that race. And then quickly, shortly thereafter, it's the pinnockers. And sometimes the pinnockers are actually exceeding what the end users are buying. And just from a monetary standpoint, a lot of these guys that are borrowing money to buy yearlings, I'm talking primarily about pinnockers, usually do it on an 11-month balloon line of credit. And basically what that means is that they pay a small amount of a nominal amount of interest for 10 months. And then after 11 months, at the 11th month, they have to pay up everything else. It's a balloon payment. It's due. And they won't renew that line of credit unless the previous line of credit has been completely paid off. So there's a lot of nervous pinnockers right now that have exceeded what they bought previously just because prices were so high over the past year. And they have a ton of inventory and they have not been able to sell other than the March OBS sale, which really, I think only 30% of the horses actually changed hands. I think that was the actual number. It was like a third of them actually changed hands. So all the rest were scratched or bought back. These pinnockers have a ton of inventory sitting in their barns, and they are nervously, anxiously awaiting these other two sales to see when they can get done because they have to sell the horses and then they have to get paid by the buyers, paid by OBS or, you know, Phasic in this example, and then pay the bank and then hope that their line of credit gets renewed. It's not a guarantee. So they need to have a window of about 4 to 6 weeks for the money flow to change hands through all those people involved before they're going to get a renewed amount of a line of credit. So it's really nerve-wracking if you have that kind of inventory sitting on the shelf right now. And Brian, I'm sorry to take up so much time, but I know that a lot of the consigners are now reaching out to some agents and saying, we're going to have private shows on our farm to basically highlight a lot of these Miami horses didn't get sold and a lot of these horses that are higher end because they need to bring back some of this cash flow so they can pay off their balloon lines of credit and then move forward. Otherwise, they're going to be out of business.
Yeah, and I've heard the same thing. I think a lot of horses are a decent number of horses are changing hands privately. I mean, the market's not going to be great. It's obviously going to be a tough sledding for a lot of people. Probably a good buying opportunity. You know, I mean, the economy is obviously not doing particularly well right now. And another interesting point is that the July phases of July sale is typically a favorite of pinhookers because they can get their hands on these two-year-olds early and get them into early training. So, I mean, September obviously isn't necessarily when they want to first have these horses. Obviously, you know, circumstances dictate that there's no other choice, but it's definitely a different phase of July. I usually think of phase of July as the precocious horses, pinhookers drive the market. You know, you're going to see most of them back next year at the two-year-old sales. So it's a little different dynamic there. And it'll be interesting to see how it affects the entire yearling season, you know, with it being right on top of Keeneland September like that. And then, you know, Phasic October, I've kind of always thought is probably the best buying opportunity for yearlings because a lot of people have kind of already spent their money. And, you know, if you're there on the last day of Phasic October, you don't see as many people. It'll be interesting to see if with everything shifting, if that dynamic changes and if that market's maybe a little stronger, or there's just more people still looking for horses, or it might just be that everyone's, you know, gone broke by then, but I guess we'll see. I know. I'm always Mr. Positive. Yep. I know. Yep.
All right. I want to transition from that into the racing implications, because I think this means them facing pulling out of its Saratoga sales. The writing on the wall is that at the very least, there's going to be Saratoga with no spectators. They're not expecting people to be flocking in. I mean, you know, it makes sense. There's no world I can see where in the middle of this summer It makes sense to fly in people from all over the world and, you know, germs from all over the world and fire. It's just, it's not a good idea. Bill talked to Martin Panza, the executive vice president of racing operations at Naira over the weekend. And he said something interesting that I disagree with. I suspect you guys disagree with it as well, that they want to run at Saratoga even without fans because people will bet more on it than they would at Belmont. Now, to me, I don't understand that. I think if it's the same quality, the product is the same quality, people are going to bet, especially now, because look at Bill's favorite track, Fonner Park, handling millions of dollars, you know, per day. That's there's no brand behind Fonner Park, but people are still betting it because it's there. You think people are going to be starved for like the great racing at Saratoga and then not bet it because it's at Belmont? Like, the reason I don't bet Aqueduct in the winter isn't because Aqueduct is ugly and not chic. Like, it's because the racing product is garbage. If the racing product is just as good as it would be at Saratoga and it's called Saratoga at Belmont or Saratoga South, I think it'll handle the same amount. And I think it's just, I don't think that that's a good enough argument for why you should ship up thousands of people and horses into a community that so far has not had an outbreak from a community that's had a major outbreak. I don't think that's a good enough reason. What do you guys think, Bill?
Well, Joe, I raised all those questions earlier in my week in review, talking about whether it made sense to race the race meet at Saratoga. And, you know, my personal feelings are somewhat the same as yours. I just don't think it makes a whole lot of sense. I think it's more trouble and you're asking for problems that you wouldn't get if you just made the racing run at the downstate tracks and maybe even a little bit at Aqueduct, not just at Belmont, because they brought up the situation where they don't want to tear the Belmont turf course up and not be able to race on in the fall. The answer to that would be to race a couple of days a week at Aqueduct, or race 2 or 3 weeks consecutively at Aqueduct or something like that. But, you know, the Martin Panza at Naira, he knows the numbers a lot better than I do. And they are insistent that if they race at Saratoga, the handle will be far greater than it would be at Belmont. Frankly, I'm with you, Joe. I don't really quite get it. Because if it's a studio racing, you know, what difference does it make if it's run at Saratoga, Belmont, Aqueduct, or, you know, at the Mahoning County Fair, to be honest, that if it's the same horses, it's going to be the same level of racing that would be at Saratoga without fans. But he's saying that if they did not race at Saratoga and race instead at Belmont, the purse account would take a huge hit. And they're saying that that's the last thing this sport needs right now, is for purses at a marquee track to go down. So, I mean, I guess we'll see what happens when and if they race in Saratoga. And it's still a big if, because we don't know if they're going to get approval to race in time. And also, I don't know if they're going to get approval from people in the upstate politicians. You know, it's very confusing who absolutely has the call on this. Is it the county? Is it the state? Is it the city of Saratoga? You know, I got to imagine some people in the Saratoga community are not happy about the fact of bringing 1,500 outsiders in and plopping them into your community in the middle of a pandemic. But Naira is very set on what they want to do. And at least, you know, now we know the rationale.
Yeah, and I can't see why they would want to have a meetup at Saratoga with no fans, like you mentioned before, and force the trainers, who are already, the majority of them are under all kinds of financial constraints right now because they're not racing. And a lot of them aren't getting paid either the full amount or timely amount from their training bills, because the horses aren't actually running and earning money. So why put the trainers under that kind of financial burden, the owners under that financial burden? And probably more important, that would supersede even those financial issues, is, you know, right now they have a great medical protocol going on at Belmont. And Joe Applebaum was from NYFA was wonderful last week explaining to us all the medical conditions that they have put into place in order to safeguard everyone's health. So why try to replicate that at Saratoga, where they're not sure if it's going to work, when you can show whoever the powers that be that are going to make this decision, we already have a protocol that's working, and here are the reasons why it's working, and let's not you know, break something that is already a fix here in racing. So for a lot of reasons, it didn't make sense. And the quote, you know, in the article just puzzled me, as far as, well, we'd still rather run here because handle is going to be better. I don't think that's true. I think for all the reasons that you guys mentioned before, people are starving to bet on something, whether it's horse racing or tiddlywinks at this point. So whether they're running in Old Saratoga or they're running a Belmont or Aqueduct, I don't really think it makes a difference at all, as long as the quality is there.
I guess I sort of disagree with the idea that, I mean, the Saratoga brand is what it is. It definitely gets people a little more excited. I mean, maybe you just paint some stuff red and call it Saratoga of the South, or get a big green screen. But I think there is a difference. I think when people hear Saratoga, you know, for whatever reason, it just gets people really excited. So I kind of, I don't know. The other thing is, though, that I'm not sure the quality will be the same. You probably won't get as many shippers. So it might not be the Saratoga we're used to, no matter where it is. But I think there is some power in the brand. So I can kind of see what Mr. Panza is saying with that.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. I understand that people look forward to Saratoga all year, but I don't know. It's an unprecedented time, and you got to weigh the risk versus the reward. And if the reward is having the Saratoga brand, even if there's no fans in the stands and there's no economic impact in Saratoga, I don't think that is enough for the risk of sending the entire population of the Belmont backstretch and all the horsemen and all the horses up there. I feel like they're going to have to reconsider this. And, you know, who knows, maybe things will take a dramatic turn for the better in the next, you know, month or so. And we'll have maybe the prospect of limited fans, but, and social distancing and all that. But my guess is that once you get everybody in the Saratoga backyard and they start drinking, it's going to be hard to enforce that kind of thing. It's just, I don't know. It just doesn't seem plausible to me for Saratoga to host the entire, you know, logistics of the Saratoga meet without any of the fans. It doesn't seem realistic to me.
I think it's also important to note that for right now, you know, businesses, it's probably better to operate as if things are going to get better. If you just have to cancel again, or if you have to move something, you know, you don't, that is what it is, but you might as well operate as if things are going to improve. So you're in a position to take advantage of that if and when it happens.
No, that's fair. I think that's right, that you should lean towards optimism, and then you can always cancel or delay stuff later. I'm projecting that the closer we get to Saratoga, the more they're going to consider this and probably back off. Related to the pandemic, we had protests yesterday at Santa Anita with Bob Baffert and Jill Baffert were leading the way. So kudos to them. I mean, Bob Baffert doesn't need to run in California. He can dominate Oaklawn Park from afar. But it was mainly for backstretch workers. And the idea is that we talked about this before on the show, that it makes no sense to keep Santa Anita open for training and then not open for racing in the day. There's more people and more horses on the track in the morning than there is in the afternoon. It kind of crystallized a little bit for me on Saturday. Andrew Lerner, who's a trainer in Southern California, kind of on the rise, he posted a video of him driving around in his car at the Arboretum, which is across the street from Santa Anita. And it seemed as though it was open and very, very crowded. And he was, you know, asking the LA County supervisors and the local government, how does it make sense to have this open and not have us open across the street and, you know, mess with our livelihoods in that way? And I'm sympathetic to that. You know, I kind of made fun of some of the protests that are going on last week, because I think it is ridiculous for people to get out there and, you know, getting these large groups because they can't buy fertilizer, can't get their hair done. Like, shut up. Like, people are dealing with much tougher circumstances than you are right now. Let me tell you, as a New York, New Jersey resident, you don't want what's here. You don't want what's here coming to you. But when it comes to the economic argument and the fact that the livelihoods of people are being taken away, I'm much more sympathetic to that. And I think that makes a lot more sense. And I think politicians should lend an ear to those kind of people. And I think that the California horsemen have a good argument, especially because their livelihoods are their lives. It's the same thing. Like, there's no real clocking out on the backstretch. Like, I know eventually you're going to, you know, once the races are over and everything, you're going to have the night to yourself. But in general, you're with the horses all the time. And it's not just your livelihood, it's your life. And if I can't do that, then what am I even here for? Like, why, you know, I should be somewhere else if I can't be on the backstretch. And God forbid some people end up on the street. Like, this to me, that this is a good argument to make, especially since California has seemed to kind of corral the pandemic and corral the outbreak. It seemed early on like it was going to be an explosion, kind of like what we've had here in New York and New Jersey. But it seems like they've kind of settled things down. I think a lot of that has to do with the weather, because it's so hot. So I want to give a shout out to everybody that came out yesterday and socially distant protest. No large crowds, please. We still want to be responsible here. Wear masks, all that stuff. But make your voice heard. And I think, you know, it helped when Santa Anita was going through all of that, the animal welfare stuff. It helped to kind of have that counter protest to the animal rights activists. I think it can't hurt here. I wonder what you guys thought when you saw those protests yesterday. I saw Bob Baffert out there in his transition lenses. Shout out to you, Bob.
Yeah, good job by the people in California. And really, you got to include just about everybody in the mix here. The Stronach group, the trainers, the backstretch workers, the people that are advocates for the backstretch workers have done a really good job in California getting this argument out there. And when we talk about it in the podcast, it's easy for us to understand it so far as, yes, you should have racing because the backstretch workers have to come to work anyways. They're working with the horse anyways. And to have racing in the afternoon is really not that big a deal because of what's going on in the morning. But you have to understand, it's easy for us to understand that, not easy for the outsiders to understand that. So I think the education is important. And I think everybody in California has done a really good job of this. It's including email campaigns. You see it all over the place. Please forward this email to the Los Angeles County office of so-and-so. Now, they haven't won yet because we haven't heard from the county and they haven't said what they're going to do. But you read the tea leaves, it looks positive that something's going to happen fairly soon there. And on top of that, we're also hearing signs from New York and Kentucky as well that maybe they're not too far away from resuming racing at the tracks again without spectators. And, you know, since there's been the shutdown, you know, we love to talk about Fauner Park and Will Rogers and Gulfstream and whatnot. But this time of year, the three most important circuits by far are Kentucky, New York, and California. And all three of them have been shut down for a good long period now. So the sport really very much needs to get them back. And for the first time, I'm optimistic. I think by June 1st, the three jurisdictions that I'm talking about, Kentucky, New York, and California, I think they'll all be running.
I thought it was pretty surreal to see Bob Baffert in a mask and gloves. Just not something you'd ever, you know, just if you told us 6 months ago what we'd be living through, obviously no one would possibly be able to imagine it. And I think it sounds like there's going to be some news out of Kentucky today. Maybe it already broke while we were on here. But it sounds positive, like Bill said. So, you know, we're certainly eagerly waiting to hear about that.
Yeah. And yeah, just to piggyback on those points, the governor of Kentucky, Andy Beshear, he gives a press conference every day, like most of the governors do. He was asked about Churchill Downs reopening yesterday and supposedly hinted that he would have an announcement about it today. So hopefully that's the case. Yeah, I mean, we are allowed optimism at this point. There's been so much pessimism for the past month or two, and rightfully so. But I think we are trending in the right direction. I feel like New York will be the last of the three to open just because we're still dealing with hundreds of deaths a day. It's still not a good situation. But I think Kentucky, I think in the next couple of weeks, you'll see movement there towards opening. California, hopefully these protests can make an impact, if nothing else, and they'll be allowed to race again. And these places where the outbreak or the virus is much more confined and controlled, I think that you have a much, much better shot of resuming racing. I hope by June 1st we're back racing in New York. I would say sometime in June, I think, is probably realistic. And then we'll, you know, get into the discussion of Saratoga and whether or not we're going to see a traditional Saratoga meet. But yeah, I think it's good to have some kind of optimism now. And hopefully by the summer, we'll be mostly back to normal. But just got to take it day by day, as we've been doing.
So I just kind of wanted to finish things off. I had a little bit of an axe to grind this week. It's something that kind of always comes up. I don't think all past performance providers have this issue, but at least one doesn't always publish all sales histories, complete sales histories, at least the most recent sale in their past performances. And I thought it was particularly egregious last Saturday at Oaklawn. You had a horse, Uncle Tap, who was a $430,000 yearling, and that was the sale that was listed. He had sold for $15,000 more recently than that, Keelan January, and that wasn't published, and he was debuting for a tag. I'm certain that informed someone's bets in that race, thinking, oh, this horse is, you know, they purchased this horse for $430,000. Look at them. They're running first out in a maiden 30. Horse didn't run any well, but it was just kind of a, you know, there's no excuse for that. That's just poor information, poor, you know, that's just doesn't make sense. And another one, Me and Mischief later on the card, had sold for $2.4 million at Phasic November. And that sale wasn't in the in the pass performances. And I don't think it's every provider of pass performances, but there's at least one where I think it's just, I don't understand how it's happening, and it's just kind of particularly egregious. And then the question becomes, should RNAs be in there? I kind of think they should, especially I think it's bad with two-year-old sales. I mean, a horse could RNA for $500,000 at a two-year-old sale, work 9 and 4, and that's, you know, let's say it was a $50,000 yearling. It'll be listed as a $50,000 yearling, but there's a huge piece of information in there that I think the bettors deserve to know about. So, I mean, honestly, for someone who does the work, it helped. It's not bad for me. I mean, I have, you know, I wouldn't notice either way, but I think especially for bettors who really aren't super experienced in that area, I think it really does them a disservice.
2 points about that. Keeneland January, I think there's something with that sale, because I've seen horses who have been sold at dispersals at Keeneland January and the sale doesn't pop up. And just in general, I think in the racing form, I rarely ever see a Keeneland January tag at the top of the past performances. And the second thing, your point is good about the RNAs, because I do, you know, like you, when I'm handicapping two-year-old races, I like to go and watch the breezes. And I'm not going to run a sales history on every single horse. So, you know, for me, if I don't see that there's an OBS March or OBS April or whatever sales tag in the past performances, I don't know that horse breezed and then didn't sell. So I guess withheld is too strong, but like information is being hidden from me that could help in my handicapping. And, you know, maybe we should ask Pat Cummings about this, and he would have gotten on a 10-minute rant about it, because it's the lack of data being presented to horse players is just, it's really unacceptable in a lot of ways. And your highlight is right with the mischief thing. Like, the $2.5 million sale, and it's not even the past performances. Like, what? Why? It's right. No explanation to me.
Yeah, the only thing I would disagree with you guys on is, you know, I agree with you. Start with that. I'll start with the positive. I agree with you the fact that all the information should be, you know, in there, because it's so easily accessible. I mean, it's not like they have to go, that they have to do their own due diligence to get it. It's in a download stream for them. As far as RNAs go, I would disagree with you, though, however, because when a horse is not, you know, sold and the reserve is not attained, the RNA, basically what it's saying is that the owners of that horse thought that the horse was worth more than what the entire sales audience thought it was worth. So it's one person's opinion versus the entire marketplace. So to me, RNAs don't really mean anything, because basically it just means that the owners thought their horse or their asset was worth more than what the general public, the purchasing public, thought it was worth. So I'm not necessarily in agreement that RNA numbers should be in there, because they're meaningless. Because the horse didn't actually change hands, didn't actually get sold. Now, if a horse was RNA'd and then subsequently after the sale or before the sale was over, somebody went back and purchased the horse privately, that information absolutely should be, in the sales history, because that was an actual sale. The horse changed hands. But otherwise, RNA stuff is kind of like, well, you know, I think that my kids are the best. But the general world doesn't necessarily hire them because they don't think they're the best. It's kind of like, you know, a very subjective valuation.
I mean, I guess I disagree that they're meaningless, because there still was a market determination on that horse. There's still like, it still went up to a certain price point. And then, yeah, the price point wasn't what the owners of the horse wanted, but it still went through the auction ring, and there was still bidding on the horse, and there was still valuation of some sort on that horse, even if it didn't end up selling. And, you know, like I said, like Brian and I said about the two-year-old sales, then we don't get to know that the horse breezed. Like, that's the main thing for me. Like, is I don't get to see that the horse breezed and then RNA. Like, that to me is inexcusable to withhold that.
Yeah, but, no, you know, I'll give you that.
For RNAs, like, there was still a valuation of the horse, even if it wasn't what the owner wanted in the end.
Right. And just to bore Bill a little bit more, I'm going to go into the two ways that you put a reserve in. And Brian, you know this as well. Basically, you can put a reserve on a horse live bid only, which is exactly, Joe, what you were saying, which means that whatever the last bid was, the reserve will supersede that by one bid. Or you run a reserve all the way through. Okay, and when you run all the way through, it doesn't matter if one person bid $20,000 or nobody bid at all. The auction company instructions are to run that value all the way up to at least that price point. So it's a little hard to, and none of that's public. none of the, you know, you don't know, all you know is the horse was RNA. You don't know if it was for a higher reserve or if it was for, you know, one bid over the last, bid, live bid, and there's still some room to go. So it, to me, again, it's just kind of a fictitious number because we don't know if there was anybody else bidding on the horse and they just stopped because it was, you know, it was one bid below the reserve. Now, that being said, and this will go into a whole other conversation down the road, we don't do this now, but if they go into an internet bidding process, somewhere that company has to be able to show through, for transparency purposes, what the actual reserve was. Because otherwise, you know, you don't know who you're getting bid up against. It could be the consigner, it could be the owner, it could be, you know, somebody random that's just bidding and is never really going to have any interest in buying the horse. So that's a whole nother therapy session. That's a whole nother discussion that we'll have down the road if they ever get to internet bidding. But the transparency point is the important one. And I would love to see more transparency with the reserves where you know, okay, the reserve has not been attained while you're bidding. So that way you're not just bidding against yourself.
Right. Yeah. I think it always comes down to transparency, and more transparency is better. Past performance, sales, whatever the arena. I think that's right.
All right. Maybe the fix might be, you know, I guess yearling RNAs really aren't that important for this. Maybe just a little symbol in the past performance is like a little quarter pole or something that shows you that this horse has a 2-year-old breeze. I mean, obviously online past performances can link to it, and I'm not trying to, you know, help anyone out, any competitors or anything, but, maybe that's the way to do it. Just something that at least gives people an idea that there's a little more information to look at, and maybe, you know, give people access to that information.
But like you said before, Brian, by giving the general public that information, it denigrates your advantage. I mean, you study this.
I mean,
so, you know, so we don't want to get on soapbox too high because we're giving away all of our.
What John Green needs more advantages in life, for sure.
I know with already these good looks. I mean, I understand why you guys would be upset about that.
Totally. How's the Rolls Royce looking?
It's in the shop. Thank you for asking, though.
All right, cool. This week's news has been sponsored by West Point Thoroughbreds. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. That's going to do it for this week's episode of the TDN Writers Room, brought to you by Keeneland. Entries for the 2020 September Yearling Sale are open through Friday, May 1st at september.keeneland.com. Enter now and pay no entry fees for withdrawals by June 12th. I want to thank John Green, Bill Finley, Brian DiDonato, our Green Group guest of the week, Pat Cummings, our producer, Patty Wolf, our editors, Nathan Wilkinson and Anthony LaRocca, and our production coordinator, Michelle Sobrino. Stay safe. Enjoy the Arkansas Derby. We will see you next week.